Hi, everybody. Alan Arnett here. It is Sunday, March 31st, 2024, and welcome to the first podcast for Everest 2024 season coverage. As usual, I'm in my home in Colorado. I'll be covering it again this year, and hopefully every weekend, I'll be doing this weekend update to bring you up to speed on what's been happening. So as we get going, if it's April, it must be time for Everest, and it'll be April tomorrow, April 1st. April Fool's Day. And, icefall doctors are already there. They're hard at work. They're about halfway through the icefall at this point. And they'll be up to Camp 2. That's where as high as they go. And they'll have that fixed probably in about 10 days or so, maybe at the end of the first week of April, maybe going into the second. All depends upon the weather. It'll be really interesting to see this year exactly how many ladders that they use, because that's been a decreasing number consistently over the last 10 years. Partly that's because the icefall doctors continue to find shorter, more efficient ways of navigating the deep crevasses and the windy part of the icefall, but also that the glacier is melting, is getting thinner. It's not necessarily receding, but it's getting thinner, and that's causing fewer crevasses, and so they're using less ladders. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it was not unusual to have 20 or 30 ladders in the icefall. Last couple of years, there's been, I don't know, 5, 8. So it's been dramatically less. That makes it a lot safer for everybody going through the icefall, and especially for the Sherpas that are ferrying loads up, to the higher camps for the members and the clients. So that's the first thing that we're watching, is what's going to happen with the icefall. Second is that we've got teams that are moving. They've already been in Kathmandu. They're heading up and begin to trek on the up through the Khumbu. As I always say, whenever the subject comes up, if you ever get a chance to go trek in the Khumbu, jump on it, or the Annapurna Circuit, or in the Manaslu Circuit, is just phenomenally beautiful. Any place there going and trekking, it'll just change your life. I promise you, if you let it. Seeing the scale of the Himalayan mountains and the majestic peaks, especially peaks like Amon de Blanc, is just awe-inspiring. Also, seeing the kids playing on the dirt trails, and the yaks coming by. Remember, always be uphill when you pass a yak, because a yak, they're so big and cumbersome, and they've got big loads on them, that if you're on the downhill side, it's easy to get knocked off and down into the Dodikosi River. So always be on the uphill side and defer to the yaks. Don't get in an argument with a yak. So, but also just, seeing the monasteries and the monks, and just, people spinning prayer wheels. It's just an awe-inspiring environment that, like I say, if you ever get a chance to go, absolutely jump on it. So our teams are now arriving. There's multiple teams now trekking through the Khumbu. Most teams end up going directly to Everest Base Camp, but some will go to Lobache, a so-called trekking peak, 20,000 foot trekking peak. They'll go to the fore summit of Lobache for acclimatization. That will reduce the number of rotations that they go through the icefall, at least on the Nepal side, by at least one, if not more than that, in an effort to really avoid going through that icefall as much as possible. So that'll be probably the first stop for several teams. Then they'll move on to base camp, where they'll get settled in. And we'll start seeing the first clients moving through the icefall somewhere around April 15th. So we still got a couple of weeks before anything major starts to happen on the mountain in terms of the teams climbing. Over on the north side, China has reopened Everest for the first time in 4 years. It was closed for COVID for a few years, and last year they kind of drug their feet on getting the visa process going. And so most teams, all teams didn't go last year. So this is the first time we're going to see foreign teams back on the Tibet side of the mountain. Of course, the Tibet side is steeped in a history with Mallory and Irvine, and what I think is one of the greatest mysteries in all of sports, and certainly in mountaineering. Did they summit? Did they die going up or coming down? It's one of these enduring subjects that I'm not sure we'll ever really know the answer to. Of course, Mallory's body was found in 1999, and Irvine's was not found, despite a valiant effort looking for it a couple of years ago by a Nat Geo team with Mark Sinat and others. And they thought they knew where it was. They thought they had some aerial photography. They thought exactly where it was going to be, the body hidden in some rocks, but they got to that part and nothing, didn't find it. So, one of the rumors is that the Chinese found the body decades ago and it brought it back down. Of course, the other part of that mystery is was the camera on Irvine? It wasn't on Mallory when they found his body. And they could find that camera and they could develop the film, which Kodak said they could, if it, if it hadn't been opened, it would still be around. 100 years later, then that might show that they either summoned it or they didn't, but it's kind of a moot point because they didn't find the camera. So, but on the north side, we'll have lots of teams there. Of course, Adrian Bollinger with his Alpenglow team, Lucas Reutenbach with his team. They'll be the major foreign operators there. There may be a few others, like Kerry Kobler likes to go there. Summit Climb likes to go there. And of course, the cadre of the Nepali teams, Climb Baya and others, they'll all probably be there as well. The Chinese limit the number of permits on the north side to only 300, whereas on the Nepal side, there are no limits. So, you'll probably see a couple of hundred people on the Tibet side, so it won't be nearly as crowded as what we're going to see on the Nepal side. I'm expecting record-breaking number of people this year. This year, the permit to climb Everest on the Nepal side is $11,000. That's for the permit only. The average person will pay between 35 and 40,000 to climb it. Some people will pay up to 100,000 going with one of the Western operators, but most of the Nepalis are in that 35 to 40 range, and most of the Westerns are at $65,000 to $70,000 range. But next year, the permit price is going to go from 11 to 15,000, 11 to 15,000, and so that's why I'm anticipating this year just record number of permits to be issued on top of the record number of permits that were issued last year in 2023. I think it was 478. I think that was the number of permits that was issued last year. Could be off on that just a little bit, but it's in that ballpark. So, lots of people. I will not be surprised if we see 600 permits issued to foreigners. And then, on average these days, every member or client or paying customer has at least one Sherpa supporting them. In many cases, it is two. So, on average, it works out to be about one and a half. So, that would be 900 Sherpas that would be supporting 600 foreigners. And, I'm not sure that there are 900 Sherpas that are qualified to climb. Just because you're a Sherpa doesn't mean you have all the skills, the necessarily training, the experience, the medical training, the cultural skills in order to lead somebody to climb the world's highest mountain. So it'll be interesting to see how this season develops. I'll be watching it with great, a great care this year. Another thing to be looking out for is what kind of weather are we going to get? This past spring, this past winter rather, was a very warm winter. It was warmer and drier in Nepal than in the previous decade. And temperatures, according to an article in the Nepali Times, said that the temperatures were higher in the winter average, while the precipitation was lower than average. Okay, so what that means is that you don't have as much snow. You've got warmer temperatures, so that means that things like snow bridges are more common. And walking across a snow bridge and punching through it and falling into a crevasse, that's what I did in 2003 when I dropped through a snow bridge just out leaving Camp One. And I can tell you what you don't want to do. It's not recommended. Do not do this. Do not try this at home. Falling into a crevasse. And it can be very deadly. And I was very fortunate that my two teammates, I was roped up to them. We didn't have fixed ropes in those days. So I was roped up to them and they were able to pull me out. But it really got my attention. I'll just leave it at that. The other thing about not having a lot of snow, now there's going to be snow on the mountain. Make no mistake about that. The question is how much snow is there? But if you don't have a lot of snow, that snow tends to hold the rocks to the mountainside. It kind of acts as a glue. If you don't have a lot of heavy, fresh snow, then the opportunity for rock fall increases. And so that makes it, objective dangerous. Rock fall, avalanches, probably not going to be a huge concern this year given the numbers that we're seeing. But, the weather, who knows? Who knows how to predict it? We'll talk to Mark DeKeyser and Chris Tomer and Michael Fagan throughout the season to kind of get their eyeballs on it. And maybe we'll do another podcast like I did a couple of years ago, get all three of them on the horn and pick their brains about what's really going to happen this year with relative to the weather. Hey, a couple of things I want to bring up. Everest in the media. There's a new movie out called Pasang in the Shadow of Everest. It's about Pasang Lhamu Sherpa's journey to become the first Nepalese woman to summit Mount Everest. back in 1993. I've seen the trailers for it. I've got all the links on my website, so and onto the blog for this weekend update. So I'd invite you to check it out. It's showing in limited release in the U.S. and Canada. Another Everest in the media I want to point out is a book that was written by Sirka Sherpa and Dr. Jana Wingle. They collaborated to create a book called "The Sherpas and Their Original Identity." It really goes through the cultural and the historical perspective on the Sherpa people, kind of seeing how what their way of life has been and how it's evolved over the years. Again, a highly recommended, really good book. Also, there's other activity going on besides on Everest. We've got activity on all of the almost all of the 8,000 meter mountains, either in Tibet or Nepal. Of course, in that Choyo-U and Everest, they straddle the border with China, with Tibet. But there's also Annapurna and Manaslu, Dalagiri, Makalu, Lhotse, and Kanchenjunga with that straddles the border with India. And there'll be an activity on all of that. One that we won't see a lot of commercial activity is on Shish. That's because last year, as you may recall, in the autumn, there were four deaths on the mountain caused by avalanches. And it did take the life of one Sherpa that was very instrumental in helping to co-create the record of summiting all 8,000-meter mountains in 92 days, along with Norwegian Kristin Harla. So Kristin is going to go back to try to find her climbing partner's body, Tenzin Lama Sherpa. So that'll be an interesting one to watch. It was a very deadly avalanche. There were two separate avalanches that killed two different teams of people. Four people in total died last autumn, and China closed the mountain as a result of that this year to climbing. We don't know when it'll reopen for all the commercial teams, but anyway, we'll be watching Kristin and wish her best of luck in that endeavor to find her buddy. Over at Annapurna, my buddy Chris, over Altitude Junkies, they're checked in. They say they're doing really well. They spent a couple of nights up at Camp One. They tagged Camp Two. Annapurna has often climbed before any of the other 8,000-meter mountains. It's a little bit of a change that's happened over the last handful of years. There's a little bit of a weather window that opens up on Annapurna, then opens up on the other 8,000-meter mountains, especially Everest, which that weather window is typically in the second half of May. But the guys are there with the Altitude Junkies team, and wish them the best. A big shout out to that whole crew. And we're kind of wrapping up on this one. We lost some big names in mountaineering here over the last month or so. One was my very, very good friend, George Bosch. He was the founder of the Himalayan Stove Project. He passed away on February 23rd in an auto accident where a person crossed the lane and had a head-on collision with George. George was really just a force to be reckoned with. I was very fortunate to serve on the board of directors of the Himalayan Stove Project. And he founded this back in 2009, actually founded in 2011. After going to Nepal, actually was part of the team, the historic team with Eric Weinemer, that when he became the first blind person to summit Everest, and he George went there, and he was really inspired by Nepal, but he also was appalled by the amount of smoke inside Sherpas' homes. So he founded the Himalayan Stove Project as a way of donating smokeless cook stoves that went into people's homes, and it just he impacted like over he was it's estimated he impacted over 50,000 people, and delivered with his team, Kai and others over in Nepal, over 6,500 clean cook stoves. So George was really, again, a force to be reckoned with. Anybody who went to any of the mountaineering or outdoor research shows saw him with his big stove hat. He called himself the chief cook of the Himalayan Stove Project. And I'll miss you, my dear friend. You made a lot of changes in the world, and a lot of changes for the better. Another person who's passed away with Lew Whitaker. He also has an incredible impact by founding, along with his brother, founding RMI, Rainier Mountaineering Incorporated. He passed away at his home in Washington State at the age of 95. It's estimated that he introduced over 100,000 people, RMI did, to mountaineering by climbing on Mount Rainier. I got a chance to meet him one time when I was there climbing Rainier, and just a he, along with his twin brother, just did amazing things on with Rainier and grew RMI into a global mountaineering guide company. And another person that had a major impact in mountaineering was David Shears. He died on March 14th in his home of natural causes. Of course, David was really well known for leading the IMAX film that really kind of introduced a lot of the world to climbing Mount Everest. He was there in 1996 with the IMAX crew. They filmed it. And of course, he then became an integral part of the 1996 disaster that took 8 lives when a surprise storm moved in and trapped people high up on the mountain, mainly with adventure consultants and Mountain Madness. David was, he dropped off everything and donated oxygen and other supplies to help the rescue and searchers try to find those people in 1996. But he went on to climb Everest multiple times. And, I like this quote he said that he told the New York Times, actually pulled this from a PBS interview in 2008, where Bashir said, "Climbing Everest says that you have done something extraordinary, that you have stepped outside the routines of ordinary life, endured hardship, and accepted a great challenge. There is only one highest place on earth." Well said, David. Well said. Thanks to all three of those for their contributions to the mountaineering community. You were a force of positive influence for which we're all eternally grateful. Okay, I'm going to wrap this one up. Not very much this week. The other ones may be a little bit longer, but hopefully everybody's going to have a great time trekking into base camp or driving to base camp on the north side. And we'll do another weekend update next week. Climb on. This is Alan. And remember, memories are everything.